are halfway through the week here in the Main Street studio. Welcome to today's show. It's Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half today, Prairie Plate sits down with Peter Schultz, olive oil importer, art enthusiast, and former Concordia professor, to explore the story behind his Greek olive oil venture. Schultz shares how a personal connection to the land, traditional harvesting methods, and gravity filtration combine to create an antioxidant-rich oil with distinctive flavor variations each year. Plus, we'll talk easy, delicious ways to enjoy it and the emerging science behind olive oil's powerful health benefits. And we'll also have another edition of our news podcast, Prairie Beat. And we begin Main Street today with what was one of the most talked about local elections in recent North Dakota history, a special mayoral race in Minot that drew statewide attention with a field of four candidates, including two with criminal records and one backed by far-right activists. The race became a flashpoint of sorts for political tensions. In the end, voters chose a more moderate path, electing the current interim mayor, Mark Janser. To help us understand what happened and what it means for the future of politics in Minot and beyond, we're joined by our friend, Minot resident Rob Port. He's a columnist, podcaster, and longtime political observer who's called this race, and I quote here, a revenge of the normies. Rob has closely followed the campaign and its broader implications for the state. Rob, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig, for having me on.
What just happened in Minot, Rob, and why does it matter?
Well, what happened in Minot, we had a four-way race. And boy, I mean, if you've followed politics, trying to handicap a four-way nonpartisan race held in August of an off-year, off-election year, it's hard to know who's going to show up. But last night, probably one of the most interesting parts of that election in Minot was that the turnout was high. Now, I don't say it wasn't high relative to the number of people in Minot that could have voted.
5,500 votes cast.
5,500 votes cast, but that's not a lot. Minot has tens of thousands of eligible voters. More people should have voted. I wish they had. Maybe that's a topic for another day. Still, that number was larger than the last regular city council meeting last, or city council election last year, and it was about 1,100 votes more than the last regular mayoral election the cycle before that. So this is, just a really interesting outcome. And the fact that, you know, you had two sort of very right-wing candidates versus two very, you know, moderate candidates. Ultimately, one of those moderate candidates won. And frankly, if the other moderate candidate got out, Paul Pittner, if he had gotten out of the race, you look at Mark Janser, who won and is now, you know, going to be Minot's mayor for the next 10 months. He probably gets to 60% if Pittner's not in that race.
You call this the revenge of the normies. Before we get to that, why did we have the election?
So we had the election because the previous mayor, Tom Ross, resigned. And he resigned probably because of some of my reporting where he had sent a wildly inappropriate text message to the city attorney. It was during business hours, during a weekday. In fact, the city attorney and the mayor, according to her comments in the internal city investigation, they had been having a conversation about a Minot police officer who had taken his own life at the police department. They were discussing that. Obviously, that's, you know, the city was discussing, you know, how they're going to handle things and whatnot. Shortly after that phone call ended, Mayor Ross sent a pornographic video of himself to the city attorney. So, when that came out, he ultimately resigned. The city could have appointed an interim mayor. And in some ways, I wish they had done that because this election was costly and the winner of this election only gets to be mayor for the next 10 months anyway. I feel like we could have just decided this on next year's ballot. But, the law allows citizens to petition to hold an election instead. Josiah Royce, who is one of the four candidates in this race, he filed petitions, filed signatures to force a special election. And that's what we just had.
Revenge of the normies. If this election would have been held 1 year ago, do you think the outcome would have been the same?
I don't know. You know, that's a good question. I don't think it could be. And again, I want to put some caveats here that I don't want to hold up a special election with a relatively low turnout? I mean, obviously a higher turnout for hyper-local elections, but in terms of like general elections, statewide races, even legislative races, how much do you read into this? And I think you can read some into this. One of the most interesting political storylines in North Dakota that I've been following for years now is a fracturing in the North Dakota Republican Party, where you have really the most consequential political divide in the state is not between Republicans and Democrats, but between one faction of what I would call traditional or normie Republicans.
More moderate, perhaps.
Yeah, that's a fair way of saying it. Although Democrats might not think some of those traditional Republicans are all that moderate, but I call them traditional. I think that's more, but whatever you want to say. I think people know who I'm talking about. Between them and sort of, this new wave of populist, you know, very mega aligned newcomers. And it's been, it's been a fight. And Minot, in a lot of ways, has been the epicenter of that. One of the big organizers for, sort of the populist wing of the party was Jared Hendricks. He was formerly from Minot. Now he's since moved to Fargo and been elected to the state legislature from there. But he was previously in Minot. Some of the most extreme lawmakers in the legislature are elected from Minot. Representative Lori Van Winkle, Representative Jeff Hoverson. And so in a city like Minot that is electing people like that, to see them, sort of eschew a two very, very right-wing candidates in favor of a longtime moderate Republican. Now, this was officially a nonpartisan race, but Mark Janser's been involved in local Republican politics for a long time. To see someone like him win and win decisively, it wasn't particularly close, and win an election that saw a turnout that was high relative to other, hyper-local elections, it makes you think for a minute, is the tide turning? Now, it's too early to conclude that it is, but it is an interesting data point.
The group you may be talking about, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, is this Freedom League of North Dakota, which was kind of officially, use that in air quotes, launched in June of 2025, and they are unapologetic conservatives is how I might describe them. And they intend to influence policy and recruit candidates who align with their far right values. What will you be looking for to see if North Dakota might be coming a little back towards center, certainly not farther to the right? What's going to be on your horizon to analyze?
Yeah, I mean, the Freedom League's a factor. That one of the founders of the Freedom League is Mike Blessem. He's an alderman here in Minot. He backed Rob Fuller in that mayoral race. So obviously they didn't do very well. That's the Freedom League. Another political faction, the Sons of Liberty, who have been very active in state Republican politics.
They made an endorsement in this election too, correct?
Right. And they gave money to Hosiah Royce, sheriff, a former Arizona sheriff, Richard Mack, who's on the Oath Keepers board of directors. He's the leader of the Constitutional Sheriff Movement up here in Minot. Hosiah Royce's campaign literature identified him as the constitutional mayor. He got involved. He paid a visit to Minot. But the Sons of Liberty, I mean, they're very active. In fact, they're based out of Tioga. Their tiny rural district, I think at the state Republican convention 2 years ago, they sent more delegates than any other NDGOP district in the state. They are very organized and very active, but they too got creamed in this race. As far as what, I'm looking for, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch how much, traditional Republicans participate in NDGOP events. So the state convention next year for the NDGOP is going to be very interesting. The state party has been taken over by, sort of the populist wing. One of the first things they did is they censured Republican Governor Kelly Armstrong twice over his property tax bill and over his veto of a book ban bill. Does Kelly Armstrong go to the state convention next year? We actually asked him on my podcast, Plain Talk, and he said, he wouldn't say yes or no at that point, which is interesting when you have, really in a lot of ways, the top elected leader in the Republican Party of North Dakota, not confirming whether or not he's going to the party state convention you know, that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. Candidate recruitment is going to be another interesting thing. You know, in some of these legislative districts, are you know, normie political interests going to, you know, get involved? I think last election cycle, they had a pretty good cycle where you saw former state rep Brandon Pritchard through his group Citizens Alliance, which is another sort of organization within that populist milieu in the state. He campaigned against, he was running endorsing 18 candidates, some incumbents, but a lot of challenges to sitting incumbents, Republican incumbents as well, in last year's primaries, and mostly lost. I think only four of his candidates succeeded. In fact, he lost his own primary. So it's going to be more stuff like that. You know, it might be a little while before we get more data points, you know, primaries and conventions and whatnot to really see what's what. But it's going to be interesting to watch the North Dakota Republican Party continue to evolve, how representative of actual, you know, statewide Republican candidates is the North Dakota Republican Party.
We're enjoying our conversation with Rob Port. He's the podcaster, leader of Plain Talk. It's North Dakota's top political podcast. He's also a longtime political observer, columnist for the Forum. Rob, you called this mayor's race in Minot brutal. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so it was, the candidates had, a couple of the candidates had records. Josiah Royce had a long list of criminal records or criminal cases in North Dakota. Also had one. At one point, he was charged with being a fugitive for justice in North Dakota. Now, that charge was ultimately dismissed because he was extradited to Florida, where he was convicted of resisting arrest. I guess that when the incident happened, he was pulling a trailer or something in Florida, had a bunch of aluminum or metal on it. It wasn't secured properly. Officer pulled him over. Then he then refused to provide his driver's license, refused to cooperate, to the point where it escalated to a resisting arrest charge that he was ultimately convicted of. But he ducked out on that and came back to North Dakota and had to be extradited back to Florida for that. So you have those records out there. Josiah Royce was also simultaneous to his campaign suing the city of Minot, suing the Ward County Sheriff's Department over search warrants that were executed on his home and his place of business. He's a construction contractor. They were looking for bomb-making materials. Now, those search warrants ultimately resulted in the conviction of one of Mr. Royce's employees and associates who did build a bomb and detonated it in a ditch. He was convicted of two felonies for that. Mr. Royce was not convicted of anything, but felt that those search warrants were inappropriately executed on him. So he was suing, you know, Ward County and the city of Minot. Rob Fuller had a, you know, domestic violence case from 2009, misdemeanor. Now he got a deferred sentence, which he satisfied by completing community service and domestic violence counseling, as well as paying some fines. Now, when that came out, he insinuated that I had accessed those records illegally. I did not. They're misdemeanors in Colorado are publicly available in the same way that misdemeanors in North Dakota are. I mean, these are public documents. He also sent a cease and desist letter to one of his opponents, Paul Pittner, or threatening legal action if he didn't stop basically talking about the domestic violence case. So there was that. Mr. Fuller also had a significant amount of unpaid property taxes. Last time I looked, it was up to nearly $17,000 in unpaid property taxes. So, I mean, it was wild. I mean, all of this stuff. And I've never seen a local election like it before.
We live in a world often characterized these days as a world full of misinformation. Was there a lot of misinformation in this race?
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems is, I mean, Minot's become something of a news desert. It's really unfortunate. Some of the local media just doesn't cover these local races that in depth. In fact, I think some of the things I reported about the criminal records of the candidates wasn't covered locally by local. I work for a company that's based in Fargo. I happen to live in Minot. I have a statewide audience, but it's kind of interesting that, you know, local media in Minot didn't pick up a lot of that. And I think that's really unfortunate. And so what happens is in that vacuum, you know, we have Facebook groups and things that have popped up where people kind of post anything. Sometimes it's true stuff. Very often it's wild conjecture or exaggerations or things that are just flat out false. You know, there were some accusations. I know Hosiah Royce has claimed that people were saying that he wanted to lower the state's age of consent or something. I have never seen him support that. He has said that he's going to be pursuing, you know, defamation, I guess, legal actions or something like that. I don't know much about that. Those certainly weren't claims that I made, but you know, there was some stuff like that. Also, you know, when it came to the candidates themselves, you know, Mr. Fuller's reaction to my reporting about his domestic violence charge, where he said, you know, that I maybe accessed it during, you know, using untoward or illegal means. He was telling people that it was dismissed, which is only partially true. You know, when you get a deferred sentence, it's dismissed after you satisfy the sentence. He pleaded guilty to it. So, I mean, telling somebody that it's dismissed makes it sound like you weren't convicted. Well, he was convicted. It was later dismissed after he satisfied his sentence. That's the full story. So, yeah, I mean, there is some misinformation like that, and it's really hard to cut through that. I mean, we live in an environment where nobody trusts anything anymore. I mean, it seems like the only thing people want to trust is reporting or commentary that meets what they already want to believe.
The choir who is being preached to, so to speak.
Yeah.
What challenges does Mr. Janser now have in front of him? He's got 10 months till he needs to stand for re-election again, if he chooses to do that. In Minot, what's in front of him?
You know, I think a budget shortfall, you know, for one thing. You know, it complicating that is that the legislature put in place a 3% cap on property taxes. You know, that's a new thing. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with that 3% cap. I support the cap. But this is the first time, this is the first budget cycle that local governments have had to live with it. So, you know, they're having to watch their P's and Q's. So it's a lot of fiscal matters. And Minot, like a lot of other communities like Fargo and Bismarck and some other places, lots of places are going to have to go through and figure out their priorities. So I think that's something, you know, that he faces. Also, there's not a lot of trust in Minot right now. I mean, Minot's really been through a lot of chaos. I mean, the previous mayor resigned in disgrace. We had a police chief who resigned after scandals in the police department. We've had, you know, some scandals in the Ward County Sheriff's Department. I think the people of Minot are feeling pretty tired and feeling pretty, I don't know what the right word is, skeptical about their local governments right now. And I think that's probably, you know, A is probably negotiating, you know, what are the fiscal priorities of the city what are they going to be going forward? And then B, you know, how do you just make local government boring again? You know, for lack of a better word, just do the work, fix the potholes, plow the streets, and let's not turn local government into a reality show.
Mayor Janser now has prioritized City Hall remodeling, bridge repairs, relocating the fire station. Are those winnable goals in such a short time, or is he kind of laying the groundwork already for re-election?
Yeah, I mean, some of those, probably all of them, aren't going to be done in the next 10 months. But, you know, you can't just sit on your hands. And, you know, I mean, sometimes you have to do what you can when you can. And he's going to focus on those priorities. I think those are probably good priorities. You know, they're not sexy, but they're needed. And, you know, that's, you know, one of the things that is plaguing politics, I mean, and this is not unique to Minot or unique to North Dakota, but one of the things that's plaguing it is this desire to use these elected offices to be sort of reality show hosts. And you have politicians who focus on salacious things that will really get the Facebook comments stirred up, and will get you booked on certain talk radio shows, and will get everybody throwing tomatoes at each other. But are they really the right priorities for the jurisdiction you're governing? You know, talking about fixing bridges is not, again, I mean, it doesn't generate a lot of heat on social media, but it's necessary, it's vital, and it's sure important in a city like Minot. Minot's built in a valley. We don't have a lot of north-south. If one of our bridges goes down for construction, right now 16th Street in Minot is under construction. And I can tell you the traffic that that creates across the rest of the city, because people can't get north and south across the river, is remarkable. So this is a really interesting thing. And him focusing on that, it's boring, but maybe that's, you know, hopefully that's what the voters want. Let's get boring again.
How do you perceive his relationship with the rest of the council?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a divide. I mean, Jancer is not a bomb thrower. He's not. I mean, his whole campaign, I don't think he was, if he was critical at all of his opponents, you really kind of had to read between the lines. He's not that sort of a person. So I would say he's probably somebody they all respect. But there's, you know, there's a divide on the council right now. And, you know, one of the interesting things is who's now going to replace Jancer on the council. How is that going to work out? I have not done the research. I think they can have another, you know, file a petition to force another special election. But, you know, Jancer's mayor now, so he's vacating his council seat. So the council's either going to have to appoint somebody, or, you know, we're going to have another special election. So that might be the first sort of food fight, and we'll see how that goes.
As we wrap up our conversation with you, Rob, back to last night's election, Josiah Royce has already questioned the integrity of the election, claiming the machines are fraudulent. He wanted paper ballots before the election.
Yeah, well, I would point out, we do have paper ballots. Now, they're tabulated. When I went in and voted, my wife and I went in and voted at 10:30 a.m. yesterday. We sat down at a table and we filled out a paper ballot that we then fed into a tabulation machine. Now, if Mr. Royce has questions about the outcome, I certainly don't. You know, we can do a recount. And we have all of those paper ballots that were initialed by election officials and filled out by Minot citizens that can be counted again if need be. That record exists. You know, I think that is, unfortunately, has become almost just an expected part of American politics right now, where if somebody loses an election, it's not because the other candidate just convinced more voters. It can never be that. There has to be some sort of cheating involved. The news media did something nefarious. Social media did something nefarious. It can't be that you just lost an election. Josiah Royce lost the election yesterday. He had less than 400 votes, I believe was it. He was around 5 or 6% of the total vote. So, you know, I think Mr. Royce would probably do better focusing on why his message didn't resonate with Minot voters, as opposed to claiming that somebody cheated or did something nefarious.
My guest has been Rob Port, longtime North Dakota columnist and podcaster. His podcast is Plain Talk. You can listen to it wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. He's certainly a longtime political observer and knows a lot about North Dakota politics. He hails from Minot. Rob, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Craig.
Still to come on Main Street, a taste of Greece with olive oil importer Peter Schultz, whose small batch gravity-filtered gold tells a story of tradition, terrier, and tomatoes. And our news podcast, Prairie Beat. That's after this news.
I like bagels.
Have some salad. All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
You're listening to Prairie Plates on Main Street today. I'm Rick Eon, and my friend here today is Peter Schultz, who's a local olive oil importer, amongst other things, art aficionado, and much more. We're going to talk a little bit about olive oil today, where this olive oil comes from, the story behind it, and where you can get it locally. Peter, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Super. Rick, thanks for having me.
You bet.
Well, you know, I actually am pretty deeply connected to this area. Both my mom and dad were dragons. My mom was a spud. My dad was a cardinal from Alexandria, Minnesota. So I was born in Duluth. I grew up in Texas and California. Spent about 10 years in Greece doing my PhD, and then I came back to Concordia to teach for 10 years, which is basically the origins of this project. It started out of Concordia, basically, and now I'm doing this sort of as like a hobby job. I don't know exactly what you'd call it. I'm not sure if it actually pays the bills, but it's an incredible time.
Yeah, olive oil importer sounds like a great job to me, and it sounds like Greece is the olive oil connection. Tell us a little bit about your olive oil. I have a bottle here. I've been using this olive oil for, 8 years. It's delicious, and it has a lot of health benefits. Tell us a little bit about...
Sure. It was the project actually came about through happenstance. My very first year that I was living in Athens, this was 1997, graduate student at the University of Athens.
Wow.
The farmer at that point, Eugene Lathopoulos, was the husband of my dissertation advisor. That's how all of this knits together. He calls me up one morning and says, "Listen, Peter, I would like you to come and help me place some stickers on my new bottles." This was the first time he was ever sending to America. He was going to send about 10 cases. I mean, so we're talking about minuscule quantities. So being the appropriate graduate school nerd slash slave, I went over to his warehouse and we put labels on the bottles, right? Fast forward to 2004, I'm coming back, I'm starting my job at Concordia. He calls me up, he says, "Peter, I have an idea for you. Maybe your friends, they like olive oil." I said, "Listen, up here, I think we like butter and lard, buddy, but I will definitely give it a shot." So we put together our first order with the help of Tony and Sarah Nocello. Mm. I think it was maybe 3/4 of a pallet. We brought it over. Learning how to do all that was itself a really interesting challenge. We sold about half of it. The rest of it just sat there. Tony and Sarah ended up having to buy it from me. I mean, they saved me. Otherwise, I would have been completely in the red for the whole project. But everybody who bought came back next year, and they brought a friend or two. Mm. And that's how it's grown for 20 years since then, since 2005. A step at a time, word of mouth, all local people here just passing it around saying, you know, this is pretty special stuff. There's something unique going on with this. And here we are, you know, 2 decades later in the middle of our 20th anniversary, and it's still going strong.
And this is the real deal extra virgin olive oil, or EVOO. What makes it so special?
Right. Well, this is an interesting question. Extra virgin olive oil by itself is special stuff.
Yes.
It usually means it's been pressed without heat, that no serious friction has been applied to the oil in any way during the process.
Less refinement.
Yeah. This stuff is the next, I would say, at least one or two levels above that, however, because there's a couple of things we're doing here that are different. First of all, we don't use the centrifuge on this, right? When we strain this, it is all gravity filtered. So there is no mechanical application applied to the fruit, to the olives itself, other than the pressing.
Wow.
The other thing is that this is unfiltered. So if you go into a store, 99 out of 100 times, you will look into your bottle and it's this nice, whatever the olive oil it is, it'll be this nice green, or if it's really garbage, it'll be sort of yellowish olive oil, and it'll be absolutely clean. Our stuff, when it arrives, is milky, cloudy. This is all the particulate matter is left in it. There's no filter applied to this oil. Now, what this does is this keeps the antioxidants inside the bottle. This antioxidant content is key to the health benefits, right? It's also key for good storage. My sister, I wasn't even going to mention this, man, but since we're talking about it, maybe you cut all this out. But my sister opened a bottle from 2015 this summer. It was still good.
Wow.
Right? Now, of course, all of the sediment had settled to the bottom of the bottle. So there's like this layer of natural material at the bottom of the bottle. But that layer right there is what keeps it great and preserves this incredible bouquet that, of course, is different every year.
Yeah, talk about the flavor profiles a little bit, because I've noticed that it does change from year to year. Sometimes it's a little more peppery, sometimes it's a little more mellow. One of my grandmas was Italian, 100% from Pennsylvania, and she would always tell us that olive oil needs to smell like olives and taste like olives. Obviously, this stuff does. And go ahead.
Yeah, this is a great question. So at the heart of the project is our commitment to zero human inputs. Now, what does this mean? This means that we do not spray for bugs. We do not spray for other pests. We don't irrigate. We do not fertilize. The grove, such as it is more like a food forest than actually a commercial agriculture outfit. When you come and visit with us, we will walk through the grove and you will see that wild bur oak wildflowers are growing up around and in amongst the grove proper. Now, the reason I'm sharing all this is that it's a direct answer to this question about the flavor profile. Every year, the oil is different. Why is it different? Because we are just taking what nature gives us. Unlike the vast majority of small producers and all of the major producers, what they're looking for is flavor consistency. They want it to taste the same. If you buy a Bertolli, for example, which is, you know, a mass-produced, industrially scaled olive oil, even their extra virgin, what they are looking for there is the chemical control of the flavor profile. They want every bottle to taste the same. And listen, that's okay. I mean, no problem with that. Just like a Coca-Cola, right? I mean, you crack that thing open, it's not supposed to taste different every time. But our project, Rick, is something completely different. We want that difference because for us, it is the proof and the validation of our process, which does not involve human beings and their inputs. It just involves picking the olives in a very traditional way, non-mechanical, which we could talk about forever also, pressing it, settling it, and then bringing it here to Fargo Moorhead. So that difference that you're tasting is actually tasting the regenerative ethos that lies at the base of the project.
So in the wine business, a lot of this would be called terroir.
That's exactly what we're talking about here. It's just with oil.
Yeah. You're listening to Prairie Plates on Main Street today with your host, Rick Guion, and our guest today is Peter Schultz, who is a local olive oil importer here in the eastern side of the state. Peter, where can you get this olive oil locally? How can you order it? Where can you pick it up?
Sure. Huge question. Super important. There's two different answers. We have an order season that opens every year on July 15th. And closes on August 31st. That can be ordered online at peterschultzimporter.com order. And that is the seasonal window. This is something that I think, Rick, is really important to keep in mind. This is a seasonal product. If you are buying it off the grocery shelf, which is, again, totally fine, we don't know, and you don't know as a consumer, how long that oil has been sitting around and been moving around.
Right.
You also don't know what's been blended with. You have no clue. Our product is bottled to order. So at the end of the season, on the 31st of August, we will know how much we're bringing in. The oil will be bottled for us. So it is as fresh as you can get, but it's from this year's harvest.
Wow.
Right? So there is no other way to do really fresh oil other than a seasonal order. And that's the reason that we're doing it like this. We want to be able to look you right in the eye and say, hey, man, the reason that you love it is because it was bottled for you. And that's the truth. So far, we haven't found another project quite like this in the U.S., but that's the first side of that answer to that question, which is it's a seasonal order that you place online at peterschultzimporter.com. On the other side, we do have retail partners in and around the area where you can pick it up anytime during the year. The Rourke Art Museum, 4E Winery, Bear Creek Winery, Blackboard Art and Vargas, they're also a partner here in sort of this area. And they have it, they buy it from us wholesale and then stock their shelves and sell to their clients. So if you don't buy it from us, Rick, during our annual order season, you can always go to one of our retail partners and pick it up from them.
And I buy it always at the Rourke because I love the Rourke.
Absolutely. One of the best places around.
Let's talk about some recipes quickly. Lately, I've been getting some garden tomatoes, which I absolutely love this time of year. So I slice those. I have some Malden flake salt that's larger flake salt, and then I just drizzle this olive oil over these tomatoes, and boy, is that good. And then I had some Mulliano family sausage from Butcher Block in Dilworth, because that's the Italian tradition in Dilworth, and I kind of, there's Verde and Mulliano Italian sausage. I like the Mulliano because it has more garlic, but so I made some sausage and peppers. Being a quarter Italian, I need that fix, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this olive oil really does that for me. But any special recipes you're making lately?
Yeah, you know, this question, I have to say, man, I mean, I didn't know that we were to talk about recipes, but that's really exciting. What you're doing with the tomatoes, Rick, this is pure gold right there, because you're talking about a study in simplicity. Fresh tomatoes, a little bit of salt, olive oil. This is sort of the ultimate anti-inflammatory breakfast. Mm-hmm. You do that for breakfast the rest of your life, you're going to be tacking on years, right? The anti-inflammatory polyphenols from, you know, high-quality olive oil placed in a context like this where it's one single fresh vegetable, you can't do better. What do we use it for? Everything. I mean, our house, I think last year we went through about six cases, and that's me, my wife Darcy, and the dog. So we use it on everything. We're frying our potatoes in it. We are cooking our eggs in it. We do everything with it. Butter has almost completely exited the scene. I think our current favorite right now is actually Megan Myrdal's Midwest Mediterranean bean salad, which you can get in the Midwest Mediterranean book. She introduced us to this at Tracy Briggs Jensen's house about 5 years ago. And it just, it was so delicious. You can't go back. High protein, local ingredients, super high quality olive oil. You can eat it at any time of the day and it'll set you up for the entire week practically in terms of nutrition.
And if you're looking for that good cholesterol, a spoonful in the morning just might be a good thing for you.
I take a shot every morning.
Do you really?
I do indeed. I do indeed. And you can feel it. You can feel it. The health benefits from hair, skin, eyes, heart, you name it. The amount of research that is piling up in support of the consistent daily intake of this for the duration is become basically irrefutable. This isn't news exactly, but I think it's worth reiterating.
Peter Schultz, it's great to be with you today. Thanks for coming in to talk about olive oil.
Thanks, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and it's time for our weekly news podcast, Prairie Beat. And this week, the subject matter hits close to home for all of us here at Prairie Public and everyone who enjoys and supports it. Also, there was some big news in Fargo over the weekend to discuss.
Hey, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for tuning in for another episode of Prairie Beat.
On this weekly podcast, we hold up a magnifying glass to the headlines of the day to see if there's something more there worth discussing. And Danielle, while I was taking a few days off last week, a pretty significant story came to light, a very personal one for you, me, and a lot of people. So let's just get into it. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, announced it was beginning its winding down of operations and will close its doors within the next couple of months.
Yeah, you know, this is a big story because the CPB has been integral to our existence ever since we got started. And I figured for this one, we had to call in the big boss.
My name is John Harris. I'm the president and CEO for Prairie Public Broadcasting.
Ah, yes. The big cheese, the big kahuna, our fearless leader in these trying times. He's been great at that, too. John Harris. He's definitely the right guy right now to help us understand all that's been going on with this issue.
I sat down with him this week because I really felt like our viewers and listeners would appreciate hearing from him, and also just to help explain exactly how our funding mechanisms work as well. I've worked at Prairie Public almost two decades. John has been in public media for more than twice as long. And anyone in this industry will tell you, our model is usually under a bit of scrutiny. But overall, we've been able to sustain our bottom line. But this time is different.
Yeah, it really is. From all angles, too. Earlier this year, the North Dakota legislature, you might recall, reduced their funding level to Prairie Public, and with the federal rescission, it's a double whammy.
Right. So Prairie Public initially requested $2.8 million from the state this last session, and after some back and forth on that, the state approved $400,000. So that amounts to $200,000 a year for 2 years. And then Congress initially approved CPB funding back in March to the tune of $1.1 billion, and it's forward funded for 2 years, so that's what keeps it independent and free of political influence. But then this summer, they took it back.
Last year, our budget was right at $13 million, and $2 million of that came from CPB. We're going to lose that $2 million. The state of North Dakota, we're going to go from roughly $1 million to $200,000. So we're looking at over $2.5 million shortfall in our budget going forward.
And you know, when you hear those numbers laid out there that way, it really does paint a picture of the scope of the impact it could have here at Prairie Public, as well as other public media stations across the country.
Absolutely. John Harris says this amounts to roughly 20% of our overall budget, and that's no small portion for sure. But something we've been saying around here is that, you know, we may be defunded, but we're not defeated. Our funding model is a combination of a lot of things. The biggest source, of course, is our membership support. But we also receive different grants, there's underwriting, and we even have a charitable gaming portion as well.
Yeah, it takes a village, right, to sustain Prairie Public? Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I have Chumbawamba tub thumping in my head right now. But, you know, you could help us get up again off the mat by becoming a member if you haven't already, by the way, PrairiePublic.org. So what did John Harris say listeners and viewers might be able to notice by way of any changes to Prairie Public?
So the first thing he made clear was that PBS and NPR will not be going away, and Prairie Public will not be going away either. He also said that a lot of the real impacts are, of course, still in the air at this point. We won't notice any changes immediately. we have to figure them out as we go. But CPB funding paid for radio's music rights, licensing fees. It paid for our interconnection and how we're able to access and share programs. It paid for towers. So going forward, we're just going to have to see what needs to survive and what we can live with reducing or cutting altogether. And he compared it to a household budget if an income is reduced or eliminated.
Well, you're probably dropping the cable bill, maybe getting rid of the smartphone, maybe getting a cheaper car, a cheaper house or apartment. You're making some hard choices and making some decisions, or you're going in debt.
And Danielle, one thing I think we have on our side is that Prairie Public is in a pretty good financial position in that we have some cash reserves, so that certainly will give us a few months to see what needs to be done. And we also have great public support as well.
Absolutely. We've been hearing from our members about their concerns, and we've been very appreciative of their support, not over all the years, but the support that they've pledged ever since this has been going on. You know, we've had just last week we had a one-day fundraiser, and we heard from a lot of people, which was encouraging as well. And John Harris says, you know, while we've been handed a big challenge, we are prepared to face it together, both our employees here at Prairie Public and our members as well.
We will have to reset ourselves. And I won't say reinvent, because our mission is going to stay pretty true. We want to educate, involve, and inspire the people of the Prairie region. We'll take the resources that we can raise and the staff that we have, and we'll do the best job we can serving our community.
Very well said by our president and CEO, John Harris. Thank you, Danielle, for sitting down with him this week. That's a message I think our members will appreciate hearing. Now, this is typically the point of the podcast where we tee up three leads from the Prairie Public Newsroom, but this week let's do something a tad different. There were a couple of shootings over the weekend in Fargo that has gotten a lot of media attention, and not necessarily because of what happened, that was big, but how it was handled.
Right. We've been attending the press briefings about that. The incidents themselves were certainly volatile and violent and tragic, but the response has been dissected by the public and media. As of this record, one arrest has been made connected to a shooting death of a man in South Fargo, and another suspect is still being sought after shooting three people downtown. One was injured, one is still in critical condition, and the other, who tragically died.
So instead of three leads this week, Danielle, I instead want to ask you three questions. So the response of Fargo Police Chief Dave Zabolski and the subsequent reaction of the City Commission. First of all, you're part of the Fargo media. You have experience covering this type of news, and you've been at many of these news conferences. How has the relationship between the Fargo PD and the press been over the years?
I would say overall it's pretty good. I've been working with them for, you know, 18, 19 years at this point. The chief really sets the tone for the whole department and then the access to it for sure. And there have been, you know, some contentious times between Fargo PD and the media even in the recent past, like during the Black Lives Matter riots that happened during COVID. But they do want to have a good relationship with us so we can help them get the word out during critical moments. And these incidents over the weekend are catching fire because it was a full 36 hours after the shootings took place before the chief got in front of reporters.
All right, Danielle, so that leads me to my second question. The public was rightfully scared, myself included. We got no advice, really, from the chief or anybody in the Fargo PD, for that matter, if it was safe to go downtown, if the shooter was caught out of town in the wind somewhere. I mean, it was a very active kind of thing, and the chief was on vacation, it turns out. And he even got defensive and testy with a reporter who asked him about that. So what is the responsibility of a top official like that to reassure the public in those kind of moments?
Well, I think it goes without saying it's, of course, his responsibility to communicate with the public. And we are here as part of his apparatus to be able to do that. But of course, you know, everybody, even the chief of police, is entitled to a day off here and there, and even extended time off or vacation. You know, you just got to take a few days, Eric, off.
Yeah,
and you're pretty essential
I know.
Around here. So we don't begrudge him that at all. But in the event that he is unable to get out in front of the media, there should be others in the department who can be trusted to do that. And that didn't happen. So he said since then he does plan to work with the mayor to come up with a better contingency plan for next time.
So as of this record, Danielle, Police Chief Dave Zabolski is still employed by the Fargo PD, but he's had two Fargo City commissioners call for his resignation or his firing. it does seem like he's skating on thin ice. So does he survive this PR crisis?
That's a very fair question. And I think the best we can say at this point is that we just don't know. Mayor Tim Mahoney went on the record to say that, you know, how Chief Cebulski responded to the media about the delay was unacceptable. But he does seem willing to work with him on a plan for going forward. Commissioners Dave Pepcorn and Michelle Turnberg do not seem willing to give him that chance, though. So if they are able to get Denise Kolpak or John Strand to stand with them on calling for him to resign or to be fired, he might be in trouble. We're going to stay on top of it, so be sure to tune into Prairie Public for more news coverage there, or visit our online newsroom at news.prairiepublic.org.
So that's going to do it for this week's episode of Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Subscribe to Prairie Beat wherever you get your podcast, and be on the lookout for new episodes every Wednesday.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 6th. Who hasn't experienced the momentary magical thrill of seeing a meteor flash across the night sky in the corner of your eye? It vanishes almost instantly, yet its vapor trail lingers longer in your imagination. In Bowbells, North Dakota, a fellow named Isaac Ike Ross witnessed a real meteor close up on a summer's night. What may have started as a romantic peripheral vision turned into a blazing meteorite that scared the living daylights out of Ike because it nearly hit him squarely. It was a July night. Ike Ross was sitting alone at the back door of his farm home, located just 4 miles south of Bowbells, when he saw a brilliant ball of fire descending from the heavens. Ike heard the fearful swish of the shooting star as it passed through space on its downward course. He just about jumped out of his chair when the meteorite struck the earth within 20 feet of where he was sitting. Aghast, Ike watched as the meteorite pierced the old sod construction building that served as his seed barn. The force of its descent drove it through several feet of the shack's wall before it embedded itself in the earth to a depth of at least 2 feet. There was nothing magical about this trauma. Ike later said that he was scared nigh to death. After calming himself, Ike went to bed but slept fitfully, full of fright. The next morning, he warily investigated the hole in his sod building. Taking a spade, Ike set to work to dig the thing out, and after considerable hard work, he unearthed an interstellar stone. It was burnt perfectly black, with a peculiar sulfuric odor. Ike reckoned it weighed about 4 pounds. He brought the meteorite into Bowbells right away, and it was the center of attraction all day, clearly no ordinary stone. The blackened rock emitted a strong smell of sulfur. Some townspeople offered to buy it, but Ike refused to part with the rock. And it was on this date, back in 1910, that the Grand Forks Herald printed a story of Ike Ross's close encounter with a blazing meteorite. No one knows what happened afterward to Ike Ross's shooting star. Geology experts in North Dakota later termed it as an unconfirmed sighting. Nonetheless, Bowbells Ike Ross, who lived from 1853 to 1923, gave a fearful description of what it felt like to have a meteorite smash into the earth nearby. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can subscribe to Main Street wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, as Medicare and Medicaid turn 60, we'll look at their legacy and looming challenges with presidential historian Mark Updegrove. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.